Live from historic downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania, home of founding father James Wilson, 19th century hymn writer George Duffield, 19th century gospel minister George Norcross, and sports legend Jim Thorpe. It's Iron Sharpens Iron. This is a radio platform in which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17 tells us iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Matthew Henry said that in this passage, we are cautioned to take heed with whom we converse and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better. It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next 2 hours, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. And now here's your host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at ironsharpensironradio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you all a happy Thursday on this 27th day of August, 2026. I'm absolutely thrilled to have a first-time guest today, and we're going to be discussing an issue that is rarely discussed on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Typically, we are going to be heard discussing theological and doctrinal issues and elements of church history. But today we are going to be discussing health and nutrition from a Christian point of view. And my guest to do so is Kat Owens. She is a functional nutritional therapy practitioner, a certified personal trainer, and most of all, a follower of Jesus Christ. And she's an author with Founders Press, who will address her book, Eat by Faith, Nourishing Yourself and Your Family in Light of Creation, Dominion, and the Gospel. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time ever to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, Kat Owens.
Thank you, Chris. I'm very grateful to be here.
Before we get into the meat, as it were, of your book, we have a tradition here on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. It apparently is a beloved tradition in my audience, because I hear so often how much my listeners enjoy hearing the salvation testimonies of first-time guests. I always have first-time guests give a summary of their salvation testimonies, which would include the kind of religious atmosphere in which they were raised, if any, and the kinds of providential circumstances our sovereign Lord raised up in their lives that drew them to himself and saved them. And we would love to hear your story.
Great. I love that. Yeah. So I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I was brought to church occasionally, but I think the perspective I always had that I had been raised with was that being really religious was just some people's thing. And it, for other people, was not their thing. And that was fine. Whatever anyone chose to do, that was just their decision. And it was in high school that I started feeling a draw to read the Bible and to get more involved in church activities. And I really can't say why I had that desire at all, which I can see now is, and I think even pretty early on, I was able to see that this was God drawing me to him. This wasn't something I did on my own, that I just had this desire to start reading the Bible. And I had some friends who invited me to Bible study and had a friend there who gave her testimony, which is why I love testimonies as well. And in her testimony about her family and how her family was saved, I saw that following God wholeheartedly is really the only option we're given to follow God at all. That we can't just, it's not enough to just decide I'm going to be really Christian or I'm not going to be really Christian. that he demands wholehearted devotion from us. And once I knew that that was what I needed to do, I knew that that's what I wanted and that's what I was going to do. So I committed myself then to follow God wholeheartedly. I knew very little about what that meant, but that was when I made that decision. And since then, starting then, I was got involved in different Baptist and non-denominational churches. Then in high school, and then after that in college. And it was only within the last few years that my family got involved in Reformed Baptist churches, and that's been a huge blessing to us.
Well, praise God. And I know that you happen to be married, and I'm sure my audience has guessed by now that you have at least one baby, which is cooing in the background. I understand your husband is in the military as well.
Yes. So we have three little girls so far, and my husband was a pilot in the Air Force. He just separated and he flies now for UPS, and we're up in Anchorage, Alaska, where he's doing that, and just got involved with a great Reformed church up here in Alaska and hope to have more kids. That's the plan.
Can you see Russia from your house? The topic that we are addressing is something that has rarely been discussed in my experience on Christian radio, but it is an important issue. Our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, and so on. And what initially led you to be interested in health, fitness, exercise, and nutrition, and also to eventually steep your life in it?
Well, like a lot of people who get involved in health and nutrition, it started with my own health journey and dealing with some health problems. So I can say I'm very blessed that I never had to deal with some of the really intense health problems that leads people to this same kind of place. But for me, it was, I was running a lot. I ran cross country in high school and college. And I started college at the Air Force Academy, which is a very stressful, very rigorous environment. And I think particularly for women, I wish I had known then what I know now, that that's really not, I don't consider that a natural environment for women to be in. We know that the Bible talks about that women in the military, this is a curse. We see it talked about that way sometimes in the Old Testament. We know what the Old Testament says about, you know, women wearing men's clothing, but I just didn't have that biblical perspective at the time. I was still following a lot of the world's ways in terms of career and what I was pursuing. So it's no surprise to me now that that particularly stressful environment, especially for women, can lead to health problems, but it did for me. And I got out of college. I was commissioned in the Air Force at this point and just was dealing with some kind of low blood sugar symptoms, some digestive problems. Again, nothing major, but enough that I started trying to look for answers to some of these things. And I went to some of the doctors on the military base I was stationed at, started asking them some questions about these things, and just got really unsatisfactory answers. I was told that certain digestive conditions just really didn't exist. That's just stuff people read about on the internet. These digestive symptoms aren't real. I was told that, well, if you have low blood sugar, you're just going to have to carry around sugar pills in your purse forever. And then I had one doctor who said, well, this might all just be anxiety. You should try this anti-anxiety medication. I looked at the prescription after I left the office, and it was a prescription for an antidepressant, which, if you know much about those, are just extremely addictive, extremely harmful. And sorry about that.
That's okay.
Extremely harmful. medications, in my opinion, that just completely rewire your brain have really tragic long-term consequences for a lot of people. And this was prescribed to me for something that wasn't even depression, wasn't even anxiety, really. And with probably just a 5-minute doctor visit, you know, and this is a really common experience. So that was when I knew that I was going to have to figure these things out for myself. And so I had always been somewhat interested in diets and health and had researched and tried different things here and there before. But that was when I really got into it and really started researching and just became really interested in it. And I think one of the things that drove me to do that to start with, to start researching on my own, was knowing that God had made my body well. And it just didn't make sense to me, this perspective that your body's just broken. And whether it's low blood sugar or digestive problems or whatever it is, your body's just broken. And all you can do about it is just take this medication, use this Band-Aid for the rest of your life. And so knowing that my body wasn't just fundamentally broken, knowing that there had to be things out there in God's creation for our health and our healing, I really started getting into researching and trying different things and really just fell in love with researching nutrition. But it also was a learning curve for me to realize that not everything out there in the alternative space was true. There's a lot of people talking about a lot of different things, coming from a lot of different worldviews. And a lot of the things I experimented with and got invested in at certain points, I was able to look back and see later that these beliefs, these recommendations were rooted in things like atheism, evolution, even false religions. And so it was no wonder that they were misleading people. And that's when I realized that what I should have been doing from the start was thinking about, how do we approach this biblically? What's a biblical perspective on this? And how should that guide us as we look through the science and what we see historically? And when we start doing that, I think we can come to a lot different conclusions than a lot of what we hear, a lot of the recommendations that we are told today.
Now, can you give us some examples of how some false, unbiblical worldviews and religious ideas have been connected to nutritional advice? You know, I know that a lot of the health food stores that you go to, there may be a lot of great products in there. You may have somebody that has a lot of great advice behind the counter. But you will very often see at these places imagery and signs and plaques of Eastern religions and things like that. But can you give us some of the specific ways where you began to tap the brakes because you were realizing, wait a minute, this is coming from a dark place?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, a lot of what we see and think of as health foods, and like you're talking about the health food stores for sure, definitely have a lot of ties to these New Age beliefs. And it's, you know, environmentalism is often wound up in these as well. And so there's really a lot of this perspective that is coming from this belief that humans are basically the same as animals, and humans are a blight on the earth. The only thing, we should be touching it as little as possible. The more we can just leave nature as it is, the better off it's going to be. And that really does affect how certain people eat. You know, that if you think that the best thing you can do is eat like an animal or eat like a hunter-gatherer ancestor, that's going to mean things like, well, maybe you should be eating raw foods. Should we be eating a raw food diet? Should we be, you know, preparing foods? Human intervention, any kind of human intervention on nature, on food, is seen as an automatically bad thing. And people will formulate their approach to diet based on that. And that we can also see that a lot in just the evolutionary approach to medicine, and to health, even in a more conventional approach. And, you know, the first time I really was forced to think about this, I had been experimenting with a paleo diet. This was really common at the time that I was in college, really popular. This idea that we should be eating like our Paleolithic ancestors. And so the paleo diet recommends no grains, no dairy, just lots of meats, fruits, vegetables. The idea being that, of course, these Paleolithic ancestors weren't eating grains. They were hunter-gatherers. They weren't eating milk. They weren't raising animals for milk. And I had really never thought too much about the worldview behind that. I just had seen that people had success with it. I decided to try it. It did help me with some health problems. And there's a lot of reasons for that now that I could go into. There's a lot of nuance there about why I think people experience success with a lot of different diets out there, even if it's not the best thing. But I was visiting a friend, and this friend's mom was a very devoted Christian. And she rebuked me for this paleo diet. She said, you know, this is based on evolution. You shouldn't be eating this way. You should be eating grains like the Bible talks about. And at the time, I didn't think too much of it. I kind of just reasoned that, well, because the Bible talks about grains, that doesn't mean we have to be eating grains. And I wish I had now, though. I wish I had really thought more about that and thought, if this is coming from a completely false worldview, then what kind of false conclusions is it going to lead us to? And, you know, right now we see low carb diets being really popular. Mm-hmm. And again, I can tell you a lot of reasons why people have a lot of success with those. But it's important to understand that the worldview behind that and the narratives people are using to promote these low carb diets is this idea that humans, your pre-human ancestors, your hunter-gatherer ancestors were mostly eating meat. They weren't raising grains. The only fruits that they probably had access to were these really low sugar, you know, uncultivated, maybe a few berries in the summer. Like this idea that your ancestors were not eating a lot of carbohydrates. And so that therefore that is the ideal diet of a human today. And so they advocate that this is how all people should be eating. Carbohydrates are inherently harmful for this reason. And it's completely based on the evolutionary worldview.
Huh.
And so it's no wonder, that I think people are being really misled by that. And it turns out there's a lot of long-term health implications to not eating carbohydrates. And I've seen it countless times.
Yeah, I know a number of people. I don't know if there was any worldview that you described that convinced them to start on like the Atkins diet. I think a lot of it was word of mouth and testimony of people who rapidly dropped a ton of weight. And I've met people that did fairly quickly lose a lot of weight. I would say at least half of those people couldn't keep it up, though, because there are too many delicious things that are involved in carbohydrates. And they quickly regain the weight. There might be some of my friends out there that I'm not remembering out right now that are continuing to maintain the weight loss. But you are saying that to cut out or to radically, drastically minimize carbohydrates in your body is dangerous in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that too. People who lose weight very dramatically. There's a lot of health symptom improvements I've seen with a low carb diet. And again, I could go into a lot of details about why that is. But what we see long term is that it's actually doing a lot of harm to your metabolism. So people who stay on these low-carb diets long-term, they actually start to see that their fasting blood sugar starts going up as they develop this physiological insulin resistance, where your body's basically just losing its ability to use glucose from carbohydrates as a fuel source. People have trouble sleeping. They have trouble regulating their electrolytes. And then it's also just very stressful. So one of the things that carbohydrates are doing in your body is they're opposing stress hormones. And when your body has to make its own glucose through this, through its own process, it's going to use fatty acids from fats. It's going to use amino acids from protein. Your body can do that and make its own glucose if you're not getting glucose from carbohydrates in your diet. But it's using stress hormones to do that. So it's an inherently stressful process for your body. And long term, that sustained stress is going to create a lot of problems. And I've seen it. So it turns out that the reason we crave carbohydrates is because we're supposed to get them in our diet, and God made it that way for a reason.
So did any of this part of your journey where you were getting more and more involved in the health and nutrition aspect of life, did any of this start before you were a born-again believer, or did it all begin as you were already a Christian?
Yeah, most of this was afterwards. I grew up in a family that was fairly health conscious, and I'm really grateful for that. So I certainly was exposed to some of this stuff. I was probably eating a better diet growing up than most people. I had experimented and tried certain things a little bit on my own in high school before I was a Christian. But most of this was after a Christian and after I became a Christian. And I just wish that I had been able to figure out sooner how much I should have been involving my faith in the decisions I was making and the research I was doing.
And you have in your book, Eat by Faith, which, as I mentioned before, is published by Founders Press, the publishing house that was founded by my very dear friend for decades, Tom Askell, a pastor of Grace Baptist Church of Cape Coral, Florida, who I've had on this program a number of times. You have a chapter in the book, A Christian Approach to Nutrition. And if you could delve more into the Christian and biblical worldview aspect of the actual nutrition aspect of what we're talking about. Well, you're muted. I don't know how that happened.
Sorry about that.
That's
thanks.
Okay.
Yes, love to talk about this. So no matter what perspective someone is approaching diet with, whether they're following a low-carb diet or a plant-based diet, almost universally, our culture has this idea that if you're going to eat healthy, it's going to involve some level of self-denial and restriction, and choosing the healthy foods over the enjoyable foods. That if you have the option between the cheese crackers and the carrot sticks, you're going to have to choose self-denial and choose the carrot sticks. And that's how you eat a healthy diet. No matter what kind of diet someone's following, we almost universally see this concept that you have to deny yourself in some way to have a healthy diet. And there certainly is truth to that, which I will get to. But what I believe we have to recognize first, starting before almost anything, is this idea that healthy and enjoyable is not a dichotomy. This is not some duality that God gave us these appetites and it was a mistake, or it was just meant to lead us into temptation somehow. But that if we have a craving for carbohydrates or meat or fat or even just more food, there's a reason for that. And we need to understand what these reasons are. Sometimes there's certain health conditions that might be, hijacking our appetites in some way that we need to be aware of. But fundamentally, if we have appetites for certain foods, it's for a reason. And that God actually gave us these to lead us to healthy food. Mm. And I'm talking about appetites for fundamental things like carbohydrates or fat. Not necessarily you have a craving for Oreos that for you are the healthiest thing you should be eating in this moment. But
Oreos are not a God-breathed part of the diet.
I imagine that, right? There's some things that are pretty obvious. But that's one of the things I want people to see first of all. And I think that idea actually comes largely from this really ascetic approach to diet that we started to see with the Second Great Awakening here in the United States in the 1800s. So we had people like the founder of the Graham crackers. So these were named after this man, Graham, who promoted this really sparse diet, basically saying that we should just be living off whole grains and no meat. And he had all these other practices that he promoted, things like sleeping on hard beds and taking cold baths. And it was basically this idea that just the more you can punish your body, the healthier you're going to be. And there was a lot of religious ideas that that was rooted in for him.
Was he a Seventh-day Adventist, just out of curiosity?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Good question. So he actually was not, but his ideas, we see those directly picked up by the Seventh-day Adventists shortly afterwards. And they were the ones who really made those ideas mainstream. So, yeah, understanding the Seventh-day Adventist influence here is huge, because they also really promoted this idea that any kind of stimulating foods, any fine foods, were going to lead you into sin, and that they were also just unhealthy. And they had such a big influence on modern diets, what we believe about food, the kind of foods we eat, the kind of foods we see in the grocery store, the kind of things that are taught in medical schools. People often don't know just how big of an influence the Seventh-day Adventists have had on what we eat and what we think about food today. They were part of developing nutrition guidelines. They own a lot of the food companies that stock the grocery store shelves of the foods we see today, and really promoted these ideas about meat and just that enjoyable, fine, nourishing foods in general were inherently unhealthy. Because we really didn't see that a lot before in history. People intuitively understood things like meat and fat are satisfying and they're good for you, and these are important for being strong and things like that. So I think an important part of this biblical approach is understanding that that's really not a biblical approach at all, to think that we have to be just avoiding anything tasty, satisfying. And we know the Bible warns us against asceticism. I see this same kind of concept in a lot of modern diets today. This idea that to be, you know, it's not being righteous specifically that we're trying to achieve with self-denial, but it's health that we're trying to achieve with self-denial. And just in the same way that the Bible warns against that, saying that's not how you become righteous in God's eyes, I also would say that's not how you became healthy, because God gave us these appetites for a reason, and we need to understand better what those appetites are and how we honor them. And so the approach I take is to lay out this foundation that says that we will find good, enjoyable, and healthy foods when we honor God's natural created order for our bodies and for creation. We see certain patterns in creation about how God made animals and plants to work together, how food production is supposed to work naturally in creation. But then we also have to recognize with that humans have been given this important role of dominion over creation. And this is what is so often missed in a lot of modern dietary approaches. It's just like what we just mentioned with the New Age beliefs and these evolutionary ideas that humans are basically just animals, that the more we can let nature be nature and not touch it at all, the better it's going to be. But we know in Genesis, God gave man dominion over creation. And that means that we are meant to tend it and to organize it and to improve upon it, even to make it more beautiful, to make it to take it and make it into something different and better. And this word dominion, I think, has a lot of even negative connotation today, unfortunately, because so many people associate that with just doing whatever we want to earth and to animals, abusing them, disrespecting them. But that's not what it was supposed to be. It's supposed to be this mutually beneficial relationship where we tend to earth and we can actually improve upon it and make it better and make it more beautiful. And I think when we're interacting with creation in that way, with plants and animals in that way, we're naturally going to create foods that are also healthy for us. And that's the foundation I approached food with. And then what I do in my book is I take that foundation and apply it to different food groups, to meat, to plants, to grains, to fat. And what we see is that we can see examples where we have not done that well with creation. We've created foods out of this belief that the natural foods God gave us were bad, or we exercise poor stewardship over animals. And what happens when you do that is you do, in fact, create these foods that are unhealthy and can be linked to a lot of the chronic diseases that we're facing today.
All right. I'm going to read a listener question from Moundville, Alabama, and I'll have you answer it when we return from our first commercial break, kind of giving you a little time to mull it over. Ted in Moundville, Alabama, says, it sounds like your guest is not a fan of antidepressants. I'm curious if she has categorically written them off, or if she believes that certain patients can benefit from certain antidepressant medications under certain circumstances. If not, what would she recommend for Christians, for Christian believers, who suffer from chronic clinical depression? Let's assume that the believer in question has already tried repenting and praying the depression away, so-called nouthetic counseling, and a strict diet and exercise regimen. Thanks. And I think that that's an oversimplification of nouthetic counseling, just praying the depression away. But I'll have you answer the question when we come back from our first break, and I will reread the question to you when we return. If anybody else has a question, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. As always, give us your first name at least, your city and state of residence, your country of residence, and please only remain anonymous if your question involves a personal and private matter. If it's a general question, please give us your first name at least, city and state, and country of residence. Don't go away. We are going to be right back after these messages.
I'm Simon O'Mahony, pastor of Trinity Reformed Baptist Church in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Originally from Cork, Ireland, the Lord in his sovereign providence has called me to shepherd this new and growing congregation here in Cumberland County. At TRBC, we joyfully uphold the Second London Baptist Confession. We embrace congregational church government, and we are committed to preaching the full counsel of God's word for the edification of believers, the salvation of the lost, and the glory of our triune God. We are also devoted to living out the one another commands of Scripture, loving, encouraging, and serving each other as the body of Christ. In our worship, we sing psalms and the great hymns of the faith, and we gather around the Lord's table every Sunday. We would love for you to visit and worship with us. You can find our details at trbccarlisle.org. That's trbccarlisle.org. God willing, we'll see you soon.
When Iron Sharpens Iron Radio first launched in 2005, the publishers of the New American Standard Bible were among my very first sponsors. It gives me joy knowing that many scholars and pastors in the Iron Sharpens Iron Radio audience have been sticking with or switching to the NASB.
I'm Pastor Nate Pickowitz of Harvest Bible Church in Gilmanton Ironworks, New Hampshire, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor Rich Jensen of Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Coram, New York, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor Sule Prince of Oakwood Wesleyan Church in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor John Sampson of King's Church in Peoria, Arizona, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor Chuck Volo of New Life Community Church in Kingsville, Maryland, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor Steve Herford of Eastport Baptist Church in Jacksonville, Florida, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
I'm Pastor Roy Owens, Jr. of the Church at Friendship in Hockley, Texas, and the NASB is my Bible of choice.
Here's a great way for your church to help keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio on the air.
Pastors, are your pew Bibles tattered and falling apart? Consider restocking your pews with the NASB. And tell the publishers you heard about them from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Go to NASBible.com. That's NASBible.com to place your order.
Hello, this is Brian Nine, president of Hearts for the Lost Ministry. Our sole mission is to serve the local church and work directly with and alongside pastors and elders with their efforts to equip, excite, and educate their flock in biblical evangelism. We also provide practical experience opportunities in sharing the gospel directly within your immediate community. We accomplish this mission with training and Christ-centered outreach events designed to equip the church and proclaim the good news of the gospel. Our services are always 100% free. If you're looking to equip and mobilize your church for faithful gospel witness, please partner with us. Hearts for the Lost Ministry, serving the church, proclaiming the gospel. Contact us today at heartsfortheloss.com. That's heartsfortheloss.com. Now, have a heart and go share your faith.
James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries and the Dividing Line webcast here. Although God has brought me all over the globe for many years to teach, preach, and debate at numerous venues, some of my very fondest memories are from those precious times of fellowship with Pastor Rich Jensen and the brethren at Hope Reformed Baptist Church, now located at their new beautiful facilities in Coram, Long Island, New York. I've had the privilege of opening God's Word from their pulpit on many occasions, have led youth retreats for them, and have always been thrilled to see their members filling many seats at my New York debates. I do not hesitate to highly recommend Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Coram, Long Island, to anyone who wants to be accurately taught, discipled, and edified by the Holy Scriptures, and to be surrounded by truly loving and caring brothers and sisters in Christ. For more information on Hope Reformed Baptist Church, go to hopereformedli.net. That's hopereformedli.net, or call 631-696-5711. That's 631-696-5711. Tell the folks at Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Coram, Long Island, that you heard about them from James White on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
I'm Brian McLaughlin, president of the SecureCom Group and an enthusiastic supporter of Chris Arnzen's Iron Sharpens Iron radio program. The SecureCom Group provides the highest level of security, closed-circuit television, access control, and communication systems for Manhattan's top residential buildings, as well as churches, commercial properties, municipalities, and more. We custom install exactly what you need to protect yourself, including digital recording, off-site viewing, and connectivity from most smart devices. From simple code-activated systems to the latest technology using facial recognition, the SecureCom Group has it. We also provide the latest in intercom and IP telephone systems. In addition, we provide superior networking platforms. We'll create, maintain, and secure your local network. Whether it's a Wi-Fi or hardwire network, we'll implement the latest secured firewall, endpoint solutions, and cloud backup. I would love to have the honor and privilege of helping protect the lives and property of Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners and their associates. For more details on how the SecureCom Group may be of service to you with the very latest in security innovations, call 718-353-3355. That's 718-353-3355. Or visit securecomgroup.com. That's securecomgroup.com. This is Brian McLaughlin of the SecureCom Group, joining Chris Arnzen's family of advertisers to keep Iron Sharpens Iron radio on the air.
Welcome back. If you just tuned us in, we are interviewing today Kat Owens, functional nutritional therapy practitioner, certified personal trainer, follower of Jesus Christ, and author with Founders Press And her book with founders is Eat by Faith, Nourishing Yourself and Your Family in Light of Creation, Dominion, and the Gospel. If you have a question, submit it to chrisarnson@gmail.com. Give us your first name at least, city and state and country of residence. Just to repeat Ted from Moundville, Alabama's question, it sounds like your guest is not a fan of antidepressants. I'm curious if she has categorically written them off or if she believes that certain patients can benefit from certain antidepressant medications under certain circumstances. If not, what would she recommend for Christian believers who suffer from chronic clinical depression? Let's assume that the believer in question has already tried repenting and praying the depression away, so-called nuthetic counseling, and a strict diet and exercise regimen. I guess what he means by that is they've already tried that and it's not apparently working or working quickly enough. And Ted wanted me to clarify something. He says, please note, I did not define nuthetic counseling in my question. Rather, I used the phrase repenting and praying the depression away as a separate part of the question, though I do think that nuthetics lean in that direction. I separated those ideas in two separate clauses specifically so it would not be misinterpreted as a simplistic definition of nuthetic counseling. I guess that's what I did, according to Ted. But do you have an answer for Ted?
Yes. So I would say I do believe there are situations where these medications can get things under control for people, kind of like a stop the bleeding approach. And I am certainly not the expert to say when those situations, how long those situations persist. But I definitely do think there are times where they can be beneficial for that. And I also, also would not take this perspective that it is the only kind of solutions are going to be things like praying or repenting. I do think there are real physiological things going on there, and it can be really involved. I definitely think that these are health issues, can be health issues like many other health issues where it's involved, where the answers are not easy and simplistic, and I can't give one specific thing that I think is always the cause. But working with practitioner or different practitioners who are willing, who are really going to try to help figure out root causes, and working towards that, there's a lot of different things I think someone could look into, that I'm sure anyone who's been here, you know, probably already is working on this, but it can be involved with mold. It can be involved with fatty acids in your diet, circadian rhythms, light. It's complicated, and I won't pretend that it's easy to figure those things out or that I think anyone has all the answers. But I do think there's people out there who will help work on it from those perspectives and try to help find long-term solutions. The perspective that I have an issue with is this kind of conventional approach that is just going to jump straight to medications and act like that's the only solution and that that's always going to be a lifelong solution. The book Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker is a really, really great book on this topic, and it just highlights the long-term issues with these and goes into a lot of detail explaining how they can actually rewire the brain. And that's where my concerns come from with long-term use and with not trying to get to the root causes instead.
I know of an individual who switched antidepressants and wound up attempting suicide. So not only does that to me reveal a danger in the care that needs to be had, extreme care when making decisions like switching medications and perhaps immediately going cold turkey off of them, but I think it reveals what on earth are these medications doing to the human mind that would lead him to an attempt of suicide? So, and I don't think that's a rare instance either, from what I understand. And you'll be happy to know Ted just chimed in again. I think that was an excellent and helpful response. Before I go to Beverly in Bellingham, Washington, I wanted to ask you about a definition for functional nutritional therapy, since you are a practitioner specifically with that title.
Yeah, so this is a certification from the Nutritional Therapy Association. It's an organization that has classes all over the country and just provides this certification. And what that means is so nutritional therapy is their approach to trying to approach a lot of different chronic diseases just with a nutrition first perspective. So they take kind of a Weston A. Price approach, which is a lot of real whole foods, good traditional preparation methods, animal fats, animal meat. It's not an explicitly Christian approach, but I think a Weston A. Price approach is very close to a Christian approach. So I appreciated that. And then the functional part means that they also do hands-on training. There's certain tests you can do with if you're working with someone in person. And I don't actually do this right now, but it was really neat training that there are certain things you can feel for or use certain tests with all kinds of things. How their eyes react to certain things and just different things like that out there that you can use to determine if someone's deficient in a certain nutrient or possibly has dysfunction with a certain organ, things like that.
Okay. And we have Beverly in Bellingham, Washington, who says, I am not a Seventh-day Adventist, but I am wondering why it is statistically that they live 7 to 10 years longer than non-Seventh-day Adventists. I know that they are vegetarian and have other dietary restrictions. How do you explain this?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think this touches on something we've mentioned several times at this point, which is that even diets that I would not say are the ideal diet, we can often still see a lot of improvements with those. And it shouldn't lead us to necessarily think that, well, it's this part of the diet making that improvement, or this is a long-term solution or something like that. So with Seventh-day Adventists, if you're familiar with their approach, they promote a lot of different healthy practices. They are, of course, restricting meat, and that's a lot of what we would think of as the Seventh-day Adventist approach. But even now, today, they actually aren't strict vegetarians as much as they just recommend avoiding unclean meats is what I have been told. So things like pork or shellfish, they're not eating those. A lot of Seventh-day Adventists are still eating meat, to be clear. But they're also doing a lot of things like they prioritize enough rest and time in the sun and just generally going to have cleaner, healthier diets. And one of the things that I think is probably the biggest confounding factor with any kind of diet we're talking about, whether someone goes on a plant-based diet or a low-carb diet or they're Seventh-day Adventist or whatever it is, almost any time someone is trying to eat healthier, no matter what their approach to that is, they are probably making more of their own foods themselves. They're not going to fast food restaurants anymore. They're not getting food at the gas station. They're making foods themselves. And no matter what you're trying to do with that, you're going to be eating cleaner. You're going to be, and I could talk more about this, but basically one of the things I love to tell people is we just don't cook the same way food companies and restaurants do. If you're making more of your own food at home, you are automatically going to be eating healthier. That's one of the main things I like to encourage people to do. So there's a lot of reasons that I think Seventh-day Adventists probably do have a healthier lifestyle than a lot of us do. And even a lot of the things that these early Seventh-day Adventist pioneers like Ellen White or Harvey Kellogg promoted were actually good things, I think. But I think that their foundation was off. I think some of the recommendations they're most known for, like avoiding meat, are harmful and misleading. And we need to be, that's why it's good to know what their worldview is. But that's a good example of why we can see a lot of improvements with certain diets, even if it doesn't necessarily mean it's the best diet we should be eating.
Now, in all the communication that I've had over the years with Seventh-day Adventists, although there are some that eat meat, as far as those that I have providentially had contact with, it seems the vast majority are vegetarian, or at least promoting that.
Okay.
Now, what can you explain what the difference is between vegan and vegetarian? Because there are a lot of fad diets out there promoting both. And from what I can already glean from your conversation, you are against both. But if you could let us know the difference between those two.
Yeah, so a vegetarian diet just avoids eating meat. And sometimes some vegetarians might even say they're vegetarian, but still eat things like fish. And they just avoid things like beef and chicken and pork. And then a vegan is someone who's not eating any animal products. So along with not eating meat, they're also not going to be eating eggs or dairy, oftentimes not even honey, because that's considered an animal product. They're eating all plant-based foods.
Okay. And by the way, I forgot to tell both Ted and Beverly the good news that thanks to the generosity of Founders Press, you are receiving a free copy of the book we are addressing, Eat by Faith, by my guest, Kat Owens. So make sure you give us your full mailing address. And there is just, I don't want to keep harping on Seventh-day Adventists, but I was just wondering if you thought there was truth in this particle of their rhetoric. They, being people who claim to believe in the scriptures, both Old and New Testament, they have to acknowledge that meat was eaten in the Old Testament and that Jesus Christ ate fish. You know, it's very clear in the scriptures. And obviously, if he was an obedient Jew, which he was, perfectly obedient and involved in the sacrificial system, he must have been eating meat too. They will explain that away, those that are promoting vegetarianism. They will explain that away by saying, today, everything is so contaminated with pesticides, steroids, and all kinds of chemicals that they don't believe Jesus would be eating those things today because of that. The streams and rivers and oceans are so polluted, we can't even trust fish. People are getting sick and perhaps even dying from mercury poisoning and all that. How do you respond to that? And I'm sure there's an element of truth in that.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, a lot of the Seventh-day Adventist arguments for why we should be eating healthy, I can really appreciate. They're one denomination that really is willing to talk about health and wellness, which is something I would love to see more churches do. And I do think there's probably, there is some element to what they're talking about with quality of meat there. But the first big issue would be that their fundamental biblical approach to this is they're really picking and choosing what parts of the Bible they're going to use to promote their message. So Ellen White, who was their prophetess, one of the founders of their church and one of the most prolific writers on their ideas about health and nutrition, her perspective was that we shouldn't be eating meat. We shouldn't be eating meat because that was the original diet in the Garden of Eden. And we know, of course, there wasn't death in the Garden of Eden. It's easy to say that, yes, Adam and Eve in the garden would have been eating what we would call today a vegetarian or a vegan diet. But for them to say, well, therefore, that's the ideal human diet, misses a lot of those examples you just talked about that Jesus ate meat, that we know eating meat was part of observing Passover, that it was obviously just explicitly given to people multiple times in the Old Testament. And that what we're supposed to be taking from the Garden of Eden is not trying to replicate it, to be avoiding sin and achieve sanctification and righteousness, all these things, of course, but not to, I shouldn't say achieving sanctification, but achieving just living more and more like Christ and ridding our lives more of sin. For sure, we should be doing that. But, you know, we're not called to eat the specific diet Adam and Eve ate in the Garden of Eden any more than we should be trying to dress the same way Adam and Eve
did. You'd be arrested for that today.
Yeah, that would actually be sin. So I think that's a way oversimplification of a biblical interpretation to health and nutrition. But then when it comes to saying, you know, that animals and meat are so polluted today, again, I think there is truth to that. But for one thing, that really overlooks, it's kind of like they're only looking at half the problem. The problem is we have that same problem with even plant foods today, that they are largely sprayed with pesticides, that because of what we've done to soils through modern farming practices, our soils are really depleted of nutrients and our plants aren't as nutrient dense as they used to be in the past. This is well documented. And it turns out that animals, ruminants specifically, like cows and beef, are actually very good processors of what they eat. And that if a cow is not eating a clean diet, if they're not eating the foods that God created them to eat, if they're eating junk products and waste, if they're being given steroids and antibiotics, the truth is very, very little of that actually makes it through to you in their meat or in their dairy products. I certainly think, you know, a grass-fed cow is better. One that's not been given steroids or antibiotics is better. But with a cow, the truth is it actually makes very little difference when it comes to eating their meat or drinking milk from a cow. And other animals like pigs or chickens, we definitely get exposed to more of what they're exposed to. But overall, this is not a problem that is restricted to animals. The problems with modern farming practices and the chemicals that are in our environment, all of that, these problems affect plants just as much, if not more, than animals. There's no reason to say that this is a problem that should only affect the kind of meat that we eat, or that eating plants as a replacement is any kind of improvement.
Now, can you repeat what you were saying about saying that people, I'm paraphrasing, of course, people are being overly paranoid about the risks of eating meat and poultry. Can you repeat exactly what you were saying about that? Because maybe I misheard you. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, that's actually a good summary of it. So we hear a lot about the problems with meat, and I think there's a lot of fear mongering out there about this. There's a lot of really dogmatic things we hear about this, that you know, cows are being given these hormones and pigs and chickens are eating all these waste products. And there's certainly things there to be cautious about and concerned about. And if we're talking about just, you know, how do we treat these animals? What is good stewardship of these animals? That's one conversation. But from purely a health perspective, animals process these things that they eat. And certain animals, more or less of that is coming through to you when you eat them. And so, you know, ruminants are such a marvelous creation because they're taking things we can't eat. They're taking grass, roughage, stuff that would just be waste to us. And they're eating that, they're processing it, they're turning it into really good, clean nutrition to us. They also, anything they're getting exposed to, hormones or antibiotics, are really not coming through to us in any negligible, almost negligible, at the amount of that you're getting exposed to if a cow has been exposed to that. And again, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about stewardship aspects here of how we're treating cows in captivity or cows who that are being raised for food. But I certainly would not be concerned about eating conventional beef. And even when it comes to conventional chicken or conventional pork, things that the quality is going to matter more, I still would never want to see someone avoiding animal products in their diet because they're concerned about the quality. Because animal proteins and the nutrition that we get from animal meat is so important in our diet. You're not doing yourself any good if you're avoiding meat of any kind in favor of plant-based foods instead because you're concerned about the quality of it.
Can you define conventional beef and so on?
Yeah. So the way that cows are conventionally raised today would be, it's actually not as bad as a lot of people think. But the way that most you buy beef at the store, where that came from, is the cow is being raised on a pasture for most of its life. And then it is going to be sent to a feedlot where they are basically going to fatten it up before it's slaughtered. And at these feedlots, they can be eating a lot of things that are really not a natural diet for a cow. They might be given grass or alfalfa in the feedlot, but they can also be given things like waste candy and bakery products.
Wow.
And even fat from other cows. Yeah. We don't feed cow meat to cows anymore because of the mad cow disease, but you can still feed the fat from a cow to another cow to try to fatten it up.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of things that we would just intuitively go, that doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem natural, but it's cheap and it fattens up a cow. These cows can be given hormones and antibiotics to try to get them to fatten up faster. Even the antibiotics do that. But even there's more nuance to this than a lot of just the kind of dogmatic things we hear about hormones and antibiotics. You can't milk a cow after it's been given antibiotics for a certain period of time to make sure that that's cleared from their body. That's not legal. These hormones are restricted. And if you test beef, if you test dairy, there's very little of those hormones getting through to you. Doesn't mean I think that's a good way to steward a cow. But again, the point is just that I wouldn't be concerned about eating conventional beef, about eating conventional dairy, especially if that's the only thing you have access to.
And is there any advantage of the big selling point that I've seen in commercials, perhaps even especially in the conservative media, that seems to be a hot spot for the cattle industry, American beef specifically, and they will praise the American cattle industry as being something far superior than getting your beef at your local grocery store that has been flown in from some foreign country. Do you know if there's any real advantage to that, other than wanting to support American farmers, of course?
Yeah, I think the main concern there would be that these rules I'm talking about, where there's restrictions on the types of hormones that are used and the types of antibiotics and how much of those can be used, you just don't know what a foreign processor or a foreign, you don't know what they're doing, if it's coming from somewhere foreign. And so certain things we rely on and that I rely on to say, yes, you shouldn't be concerned about beef, might not be true if we don't know where it's coming from.
Okay, we have to go to our midway break. And once again, if you have a question for Kat Owens on health and nutrition, specifically that which she writes about in her book, Eat by Faith, submit your question to chrisarnzen@gmail.com, ChrisArnzen. Give us your first name, at least, city and state, and country of residence. Don't go away. We are going to be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
This program is sponsored by Hope PR Ministry. Hope PR Ministry is a podcast produced by Hope Protestant Reformed Church in Walker, Michigan. We are dedicated to sharing Reformed biblical content every Wednesday and Friday. Tune in for sermons, lectures, and interviews exploring distinctive Reformed doctrines. If you are looking for Christ-centered content, simply search Hope PR Ministry on your favorite podcast platform to begin listening today. Hope PR Ministry also offers Morning Meditations, a daily podcast featuring Reformed devotionals designed to nourish your soul. Start your day with these spiritually enriching messages by tuning into Morning Meditations wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dr. Joseph Piper, President Emeritus and Professor of Systematic and Applied Theology at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Every Christian who's serious about the Reformed faith and the Westminster Standards should have and use the 8-volume commentary on the theology and ethics of the Westminster Larger Catechism titled Authentic Christianity by Dr. Joseph Moorcraft. It is much more than an exposition of the Larger Catechism. It is a thoroughly researched work that utilizes biblical exegesis as well as historical and systematic theology. Dr. Moorcraft is pastor of Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming, Georgia, and I urge everyone looking for a biblically faithful church in that area to visit that fine congregation. For details on the 8-volume commentary, go to westminstercommentary.com, westminstercommentary.com. For details on Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming, Georgia, visit heritagepresbyterianchurch.com, heritagepresbyterianchurch.com. Please tell Dr. Moorcraft and the saints at Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming, Georgia, that Dr. Joseph Piper of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary sent you.
Hello, my name is Anthony Uvinio, and I'm one of the pastors at Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Quorum, New York, and also the host of the ReformRookie.com website. I want you to know that if you enjoy listening to the Iron Sharpens Iron radio show like I do, you can now find it on the Apple's iTunes app by typing Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in the search bar. You no longer have to worry about missing a show or a special guest because you're in your car or still at work. Just subscribe on the iTunes app and listen to the Iron Sharpens Iron radio show at any time, day or night. Please be sure to also give it a good review and pass it along to anyone who would benefit from the teaching and the many solidly reformed guests that Chris Arnson has on the show. Truth is so hard to come by these days, so don't waste your time with fluff or fake news. Subscribe to the Iron Sharpens Iron radio podcast right now. And while you're at it, you can also sign up for the ReformRookie.com podcast and visit our website and the YouTube page. We are dedicated to teaching Christian theology from a Reformed Baptist perspective to beginners in the faith as well as seasoned believers. From Keach's Catechism and the Doctrines of Grace to the Olivet Discourse and the Book of Leviticus, the Reform Rookie podcast and YouTube channel is sure to have something to offer everyone seeking biblical truth. And finally, if you're looking to worship in a Reformed church that holds to the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith, please join us at Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Quorum, New York. Again, I'm Pastor Anthony Uvinio, and thanks for listening.
Sharpens Iron Radio praise God for the generous monthly financial support of Royal Diadem Jewelers, educated by and affiliated with the American Gem Society, Jewelers of America, and the Gemological Institute of America. For the perfect custom-designed engagement ring or any one-of-a-kind piece of jewelry created exactly according to your imagination and specifications, Royal Diadem Jewelers has you covered. No matter where you live in the world, Royal Diadem will walk you step by step through every stage of the process and even hold a high-tech internet virtual visit using state-of-the-art jewelry design technology to serve you. They start by listening carefully to determine your needs. They're interested in making what you want, not what they want to sell you. From rough design to digital model, to photorealistic image, to wax prototype model, to the finished product, they are continually listening to your input, likes and dislikes, making any changes necessary along the way. This will ensure that your custom jewelry will turn out exactly as you dreamed and well beyond your expectations. Visit royaldiadem.com. That's royaldiadem.com today. Sterling Vanderwerker, owner of Royal Diadem Jewelers, his wife Bronnie, his business partner and manager Brian Wilson, and the entire family thank you all for listening to, praying for, and supporting the work of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And the owners of RoyalDiadem.com love Iron Sharpens Iron Radio so much. Not only do they provide financial support for Iron Sharpens Iron Radio every month without fail, on top of that, RoyalDiadem.com blesses Iron Sharpens Iron Radio with the mind-blowing bonus of 100% of the profits from any sale of jewelry to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners simply by those listeners mentioning Iron Sharpens Iron Radio when they purchase their jewelry from RoyalDiadem.com. So whether you are purchasing jewelry they already have in stock at RoyalDiadem.com, or if you're having a one-of-a-kind, customized piece of jewelry designed and created, like an engagement ring, or like taking your church logo, your parachurch ministry logo, your business logo, your denomination logo, your seminary logo, and turning it into a pendant for a necklace or a ring or anything else your imagination and creativity can conjure up in your brain. They will take what's in your brain and turn it into a physical, mind-blowing piece of head-turning, stunning, brilliant, breathtaking jewelry. And I have seen firsthand the absolute mastery that RoyalDiadem.com has over customizing jewelry. So, please, if you are in the market for jewelry for someone you love or for yourself, go to RoyalDiadem.com and mention Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. So we'll get a gift, too. We'll get 100% of the profits from that sale as long as you mention Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, which will enable us to continue to exist. That's RoyalDiadem.com. Mention Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Before I return to my fascinating conversation with Kat Owens on her book, Eat by Faith, I just have some very important reminders for my listeners. If you love the show, you don't want it to go off the air, please go to IronSharpensIronRadio.com, click support, then click to donate now. You could donate instantly with a debit or credit card. If you prefer snail mail, mailing a physical check at your post office to a physical mailing address, there will also be a physical mailing address that appears on your screen when you click support at Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, where you can mail your checks made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. If you want to advertise with us, your church, your parachurch ministry, your business, your private professional practice like a law firm, medical firm, or maybe it's just a special event, no matter what it is, if it's compatible with my beliefs, I would love to help you launch an ad campaign as quickly as possible, because we're just as much in urgent need of your advertising dollars as your donations. So send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com and put advertising in the subject line. Now, with all my urgent pleading with you for your financial assistance, I never want anybody in my audience to give your own church where you're a member less money than you give your own church on the Lord's Day in order to bless us. In other words, please never cut in to the finances that you have specifically set aside for your Lord's Day giving to your church in order to bless us. And if you're really struggling to survive and make ends meet, wait until you're back on your feet and more financially stable before you bless us financially. But having said that, if God has blessed you financially above and beyond your ability to provide for church and family, and you have extra money for benevolent, recreational, and even trivial purposes, well, if you love the show and you want us to remain on the air, share some of that money with us. Send us a gift through irontripandzionradio.com, click support, then click to donate now. And last but not least, if you're not a member of a Christ-honoring, biblically faithful, theologically sound, doctrinally solid church, no matter where you live on the planet Earth, I have helped people spanning the entire globe in the Iron Trip and Zion Radio audience, and I may be able to help you too. I've helped people in our audience from the United Kingdom, from the Republic of Ireland, on the African continent, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in all 50 states of the United States, in Mexico, and on I could go. So no matter where you live, I may be able to help you find a biblically faithful church. Just send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com and put "I need a church" in the subject line. That's also the email address where you could send in a question to Kat Owens on her book, Eat by Faith. That's chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. And give us your first name, at least, your city and state, and your country of residence. I'm going to ask one more listener question for now, and then we'll go back to some of the chapters of your book, because I want to make sure what you most want our listeners to know is asked of you. Walter in Derby, Connecticut says, what do you make of the craze over organic food? How much of it is misinformation and hype, and how much of it is important truth? Oh, I got a, you're on mute. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a really good example of where we need to have discernment, and it's good to understand what terms really mean and don't mean. So organic, that is a USDA controlled label, and there's certain rules. Basically, it's going to mean that the food is raised without any artificial chemicals applied to the crops or given in the feed to the animals. There's also certain rules about ionizing radiation, and there's certain additives that cannot be added to an organic food. So I would say organic is usually always going to be better, but sometimes it makes a much bigger difference than in other situations. And it does not necessarily mean that a food is ideal. So certain foods, if you're eating like blueberries that are not organic, that is a more significant exposure to the pesticides that could have been sprayed on those blueberries, for example. And there are a lot of well-documented health risks connected to those chemicals that are sprayed on a lot of conventional meaning non-organic produce. Other foods, however, it's not going to make as big of a difference. So something like a banana that has a thick peel, even if that banana has been sprayed with synthetic chemicals, you eating that banana, you're not getting exposed to as much. So that's one way I think people can prioritize. If that is something they want to focus on in their diet, there's certainly ways you can prioritize it that it's going to make a bigger difference than other things. Because I do think that there are health risks to those chemicals, but certain foods, you're not getting exposed to as many of them. Originally, the term organic was meant to separate food that had been raised in what I would call a really well-stewarded environment. It does not necessarily mean that anymore. Now you can have produce or grains produced organically that are still going to look like a lot of what we would think of as conventional agriculture, but they're just using pesticides that are technically natural. It does not necessarily mean that they're doing practices that are really going to help maintain soil health or anything like that, even though that was the original intention. So organic does not necessarily mean that the food is ideal. Also, there's a lot of foods that I would say are very harmful that can still be labeled organic. But it is one thing I think you can focus on, at least for certain foods, that can improve the healthfulness of them.
Now, what can you list some of those harmful foods that are still labeled organic?
Well, so one of the things I talk about a lot is I think the fats that we eat, we can trace this back to a lot of the health problems that we're seeing today. And when we look at the fats that are most common in the diet today, especially with processed pre-made foods, I don't actually love that term processed. I like to say pre-made foods, things you aren't making at home. The fats that are usually being used in those are these industrial seed oils like canola oil, soybean oil, things like that. And if we look at how those are created and why those were originally created and why those originally started replacing animal fats, I think we can look at those and say, this is the most blatant example of a food that was created outside of good stewardship of God's creation. We basically took something that was not meant to be food, put it through this highly industrial process to create something in order to replace animal fats, which is what humans have been eating forever. The Bible talks a lot about animal fats. It talks about them positively. We believed this lie that those were harmful, and we tried to create this new food, seed oils, specifically to replace them. So all that to say, I think seed oils are a really big part of the picture of what makes higher quality food, is avoiding those seed oils, using good, more natural fats like animal fats or coconut oil or something, which is not a seed oil. It comes from a fruit. It's a lot easier to obtain coconut oil from a coconut. Using those better fats instead of the seed oils, that's going to improve the quality of the food a lot. Now, back to your question, you can have organic seed oils. You can have organic soybean oil or canola oil, theoretically. And so you will see organic foods that still have those seed oils. I would be a lot more concerned about the seed oils than about the food being organic or not organic. Because from what I've seen in the science, and when I look at this with my perspective of what is good stewardship of creation, I am a lot more concerned about that.
And this brings to my memory years ago, perhaps decades ago, I saw a special hosted by John Stossel, who was a consumer advocate. He still might be considered that. And he was exposing some of the companies out there that were, in his opinion, fraudulently hiking up prices of produce way much higher than necessary, because they were being labeled as organic. And he was saying that there are times when there is no real safety benefit in these certain circumstances. And he was even talking about organic foods being contaminated with fertilizer very often and things like that. I'm not talking about pesticides in the fertilizer. I'm talking about the physical fertilizer on the food and all that. But Do you have anything to say about that? It's been so long, I can't really get into more detail in that.
Yeah, I believe that for sure. And when we look into it, there are a lot of fraudulent things going on with how foods are labeled, unfortunately. Something that was just in the news recently was this discovery that a lot of avocado oil, for example, was fraudulent. Avocado oil being another oil that it comes from a fruit that should be a lot better than a seed oil. And so a lot of people are using that as a replacement. But they recently did some testing at UC Davis and found that almost all of these avocado oils, whether they were being sold in a bottle on the shelf or whether they were being used in pre-made foods like chips made with avocado oil instead of seed oils, that these were actually fraudulent. They were actually seed oils and they were just being listed. They were just being sold as avocado oil. And the problem is probably that these are coming from Mexico. It sounds like there might be cartels involved. The supply chain is just not very well established or regulated since it's a pretty new food. There's a lot of temptation there to cut these with seed oils because it's expensive to make. But all that to say, I think there is a lot of financial incentive to take advantage of these labels, and that we can't always trust that they mean exactly what they say they mean. And the most ideal thing for finding healthy food, for being able to trust your food, would be to buy more of it locally from producers, that even ones that you can know, get to meet them, get to see their operations. That would be the ideal. That's obviously not realistic for everybody, for all foods, but that's probably the only way that we really can know exactly what the food being produced, where it's coming from, what's really going on, because these labels are also often used to try to make you think that they're being produced differently than they are. You know, you get the bottle of milk and it shows pictures of these, or maybe eggs are a better example. You get a carton of eggs and it's got pictures of these happy chickens running around outside on the carton. And that might make you think, you know, this is coming from someone's backyard chickens. But the reality is that most chickens are raised in these indoor, basically warehouses. They're in cages for their entire life. They probably have the space to move around that is about the size of a sheet of paper. Oftentimes they're cutting their beaks off so that they don't cannibalize each other out of stress in this environment. And you have to wear a hazmat suit to even go inside of these buildings. But they're not putting that on your carton of eggs, right? And even organic eggs can be raised in an environment like that, as long as they're just feeding the chicken feed that hasn't been raised with pesticides. So if the corn they're feeding the chickens in those warehouses is organically produced corn, that could be an organic egg coming from that environment. All that to say is that the labels often are trying to make us think that our food is coming from this wholesome looking environment, and it's, you really don't know if you can't see it what's really going on.
Okay, well, I wanted to explore some of the chapters that are actually in your book. I know that we've been talking a lot about meat, but perhaps we didn't cover everything that you wanted to say. You have a chapter, Meat, Death for Life, if you could explain.
Yeah, I love talking about meat because we hear so many things today about the problems with meat, that it's not healthy, that it's bad for the environment. And I just think we really have to push back against that, because not only is meat such an important part of a healthy diet, but raising animals is actually even an important part of stewarding creation well. And food production systems that are really building soil health, that aren't having to rely on outside fertilizers and chemicals, these require animals in their production. And so we need to really reclaim this idea that not only is meat a healthy part of a diet, it's a healthy part of any food production system in the environment, if we're talking about how do we steward God's creation well. And so, you know, I like to tell people that there is really no benefit to replacing animal products in your diet with plant-based products. It's whether you have health concerns or environmental concerns, there's nothing to be achieved by replacing meat with plant-based foods. And I also go into a little detail in that chapter about Daniel fasts. And I think that's an interesting thing to talk about, because this is an example I've seen personally in churches I've been to, that they want to do something to promote healthy eating a little bit. And so they'll hold a Daniel fast. And you're probably familiar, this idea that, you know, Daniel didn't eat meat,
right,
for this period of 21 days. And it's not quite clear what he was in mourning for. It might have had to do with the Jews returning from exile or opposition to Ezra's message. But either way, he is in mourning. He adopts this fast for 21 days where he doesn't eat meat. And his reasons for doing that are probably based on the events in Daniel 1, where when him and his friends are first, they're youths in exile in Babylon, they're taken into service in the king's court. And Daniel says, test us and our friends for 10 days, just 10 days. Let us be given nothing but vegetables to eat and see how we do. And so the steward over them finally agrees to give them this diet of nothing but vegetables. They eat nothing but vegetables for 10 days. And then it says it was seen that they were fatter in flesh, which is a good thing in this context, and healthier in appearance than the other youths around them. And then they agreed to give them this diet of nothing but vegetables. And so the really simplistic interpretation of that that we see with the Daniel fast is, well, Daniel and his friends ate a Daniel diet, this, you know, Daniel fast diet, so-called, and they were healthier because of it. So let's do the same thing. But the whole point of that story is that Daniel he was trying to honor God in captivity in this pagan nation. And the food that they were being served in the king's court, it probably didn't meet their dietary laws, their Levitical dietary laws. It probably had been sacrificed to idols. And so he was trying to avoid the meat and the other foods that didn't meet these standards he had, because he was trying to honor God. And he trusted that if he honored God, God would honor him in return, would take care of him in return. And so the point is that because he was honoring God, God supernaturally intervened and protected him. And so the whole point of that story, if we were going to ask, what should we learn from the book of Daniel about a plant-based diet? What we should probably conclude is it takes a miracle of God to keep you healthy. But unfortunately, people are taking the exact opposite conclusion. They're saying, let's try this. And you don't have the same reasons Daniel did for doing that diet. I think Daniel's a fantastic example of eating for God's glory, but our circumstances are much different than they were for him. So look, if someone wants to do a Daniel fast because it helps them connect with the story of Daniel, or maybe their church is doing it and they just want to, you know, be part of this with their church, I'm not commenting on spiritual reasons for possibly doing that. But if your conclusion is this is a healthy way to eat because of the story in Daniel, I want to point out that that's not a good interpretation of that story. It's not the point of that story. And we shouldn't be trying to replicate Daniel's diet just to be healthy.
Yeah, so you got to be careful not to just imitate something because it's in the Bible. There's a lot of things in the Bible that were not intended for imitation.
Absolutely.
I'm going to go to another chapter heading, but I thought since it's so relevant to the whole conversation about meat, RJ in White Plains, New York, says, I have seen documentation by a Christian apologist that one of the reasons Ellen G. White, founder of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, promoted a vegetarian diet was it reduced sex drive. Now, that might be a good thing for prison inmates and people who are committed to singleness for the rest of their life, but it's not obviously a good thing for married couples. But is it even true to begin with that vegetarianism, when strictly held to, reduces sex drive? Are you aware of that?
I think so. Yeah, I think they actually had a reason for promoting that. And you know, we think of Ellen White with these promoting this. Harvey Kellogg was a really big proponent of this idea that if you ate meat, that was going to lead you to sexual sin. And Harvey Kellogg was also a prominent Seventh-day Adventist, started the Kellogg's Food Company, invented breakfast cereal, all of that. And one of his main reasons for doing all that was this belief he had that animal products were going to lead people into sexual sin. And I do believe there was something to that. The nutrients, the fats that are in animal foods are directly going to support your hormone health. And I think someone who's on a vegetarian vegan diet long term, they're going to experience problems with their hormones and a lot of other things as well, nutrient deficiencies and everything that that can lead to. But yeah, I think there was truth to that. And where they went wrong probably wasn't so much saying that animal products are going to have this connection to sexual sins. It was their belief to start with that, what sexual sin was. I mean, it's people believe based on his writings that Harvey Kellogg never consummated his marriage with his wife. He had some weird beliefs about that and his interpretation of that. So that's probably where they went wrong fundamentally.
Yeah, and I remember seeing in a documentary that he was actually excommunicated from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Because
yes,
apparently he had more leftist views than they had.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know the details of it, but
and caring for creatures and creation, you mentioned that earlier, I should say, that sometimes people who might be vocally and vehemently opposed to some of the nutty leftist approaches to stewardship of the earth and health, nutrition, they might overlook some things that are of the greatest concern to many liberal people, and that's the care and well-being of animals. And we shouldn't leap to that extreme, because even the Bible, in the Old Covenant, the animals under the care of humans had to rest on the Sabbath too. And, you know, they couldn't just be abused. But if you could continue what you meant and what you included in this chapter.
Yeah, and you're totally right that Christians have avoided a lot of these environmental topics for good reason, because we see so much of it being co-opted by a lot of New Age influences, but just really a lot of beliefs overall that humans are the same as animals, animals should be elevated to the same level as humans. You know, that's what we see with organizations like PETA, and this idea that taking care of the environment, treating animals, that we're elevating them to the same level as humans, Mother Nature, you know, all these concepts that are clearly not biblical. But we really can care for God's creation without elevating humans to the same level of animals.
Or reducing humans to the same level of animals.
Yeah, truly, that's actually what's
happening. Yeah, right. And worshiping the creature rather than the creator.
Yes. Worshiping the creature rather than the creator, just like the Bible says, because that's so much of what we see. So rightfully, Christians are recognizing the problems with this. But unfortunately, what gets wrapped up in that often is then just any kind of concern for the environment. And Christians will talk about, oh, it doesn't matter what we do to the earth because, you know, it's all just going to get destroyed someday anyway, or we can treat animals however we want. And like you said, the Bible has instructions for how we're supposed to care for animals. And we know God cares for animals. And the Bible talks about that, that animals were supposed to be given rest. They were supposed to be rescued if they had fallen into a pit. They were supposed to be given their fair share of the food, things like that. And so what I want to look at is this way of how do we actually go about caring for creation in a way that strongly rejects any of these unbiblical ideas. And then the other thing we see that a lot of Christians are rejecting is now the reality that a lot of environmentalism is really just an excuse to expand government control and government spending and control people more. And it's pretty obvious if you look at any of these large scale, high level attempts at environmentalism now, is they're really just excuses for the government to take more control, to spend more money. And so we rightfully should be pushing back against that. What I think this can look like is recognizing that God has this natural created order for how animals and plants work together in food stewardship. We are meant to be able to take animals, take plants, raise them for food. That even involves killing animals. That's something that, you know, if you don't have this biblical perspective on the value of humans, it's hard to wrap your head around. But we can raise an animal for food, and that can be a mutually beneficial relationship that still cares for the animal and takes good care of it. And Joel Salatin talks about this a lot. He's a fantastic Christian resource, I think, on this topic, where he talks about honoring the way God made animals and treating them well. And he has a farm where they raise lots of animals for food. So he recognizes that this includes eating them, but we can steward them well. He's a big advocate of regenerative agriculture, which is these farming practices that are used that can really restore soil health, create healthy foods, animals. It has animals and plants working together. So I love some of these principles in regenerative agriculture. I think they're a great example of what good stewardship of creation can be. So, for example, in these kind of, in like a regenerative farm, how they might be raising cows, for example, is taking cows in a pasture and rotating them frequently between different small plots of land on the pasture. And what that does is it mimics how ruminants in nature, say a bison or a deer or something, how they naturally move in herds and they stay close together to avoid predators or to keep themselves safe from predators. And they naturally move around in these small condensed groups. And what that does is that's actually really beneficial for the grasslands that, say, bison are grazing on in nature, because the animals come in, they aerate the soil with their hooves. And when they're in this close, compact group, they essentially mow the grass. They're pruning the grass by eating it, which is actually good for it. And then they're leaving fertilizer with their manure. And then they move on to a new place. And then the ground can recover from that and use all the inputs of the fertilizer. And that's actually making the soil healthier. It's making the grasses healthier. But you don't get that same benefit if you have animals roaming on an open, like cows in a big open pasture, or if they're overgrazing, for example. But then you also have other animals that are part of this system. Chickens are an animal that is meant to be following ruminants. And what they do is they peck apart the manure. They're eating out bugs and insects that can become contamination risks. They're spreading out that manure so it doesn't become a contamination risk. And it turns out that those bugs and the plants that they're eating, that's a really natural diet for chicken. So then you can also be raising really healthy, really nutrient-dense chickens in that system. And so you have this whole cycle that is creating better soil, better grass, better cows, better chickens. And that's just one example of these kind of practices that are being, I'd say, getting more popular now, being developed on larger scales, how these can be implemented on larger scales. And these are fantastic examples of ways that we can care for God's creation and still produce food out of it at the same time.
Well, we have to go to our final break, and you can't let me forget to ask you when we return. One of the chapter titles that shocked me, I wasn't expecting it, Sugar, the Strongest God-Given Appetite. Dying to find out about that. And don't go away. We are going to be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
I'm Dr. Tony Costa, professor of apologetics and Islam at Toronto Baptist Seminary. I'm thrilled to introduce to you a church where I've been invited to speak and have grown to love, Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Coram, Long Island, New York, pastored by Rich Jensen and Christopher McDowell. It's such a joy to witness and experience fellowship with people of God like the dear saints at Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Coram, who have an intensely passionate desire to continue digging deeper and deeper into the unfathomable riches of Christ in His Holy Word, and to enthusiastically proclaim Christ Jesus the King and His doctrines of sovereign grace in Suffolk County, Long Island, and beyond. I hope you also have the privilege of discovering this precious congregation and receive the blessing of being showered by their love, as I have. For more information on Hope Reformed Baptist Church, go to hopereformedli.net. That's hopereformedli.net. Or call 631-696-5711. That's 631-696-5711. Tell the folks at Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Coram, Long Island, New York, that you heard about them from Tony Costa on Iron Sharpens Iron.
Such a blessing to hear from Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners from all over the world.
Here's Joe Riley, a listener in Ireland, who wants you to know about a guest on the show he really loves hearing interviewed, Dr. Joe Moorcraft.
I'm Joe Riley, a faithful Iron Sharpens Iron radio listener here in Athy in County Kildare, Ireland, going back to 2005. One of my very favourite guests on Iron Sharpens Iron is Dr. Joe Moorcraft. If you've been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, Dr. Moorcraft and Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming, Georgia, are largely to thank, since they are one of the program's largest financial supporters. Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming is in Forsyth County, a part of the Atlanta metropolitan area. Heritage is a thoroughly biblical church, unwaveringly committed to Westminster standards. And Dr. Joe Moorcraft is the author of an 8-volume commentary on the larger catechism. Heritage is a member of the Hanover Presbytery, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, and tracing its roots and heritage back to the great Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. Heritage maintains and follows the biblical truth and principles proclaimed by the Reformers: Scripture alone, grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone, and God's glory alone. Their primary goal is the worship of the triune God that continues in eternity. For more details on Heritage Presbyterian Church of Cumming, Georgia, visit heritagepresbyterianchurch.com. That's heritagepresbyterianchurch.com. Or call 678-954-7831. That's 678-954-7831. If you visit, tell them Joe Riley, an Iron Sharpens Iron radio listener from Athy in County Kildare, Ireland, sent you.
Allen of Lynbrook Baptist Church, a Christ-centered, gospel-driven church looking to spread the gospel in the southwest portion of Long Island, New York, and play our role in fulfilling the Great Commission, supporting and sending for the spread of the gospel to the ends of the earth. We're delighted to be a part of Chris Arnzen's Iron Sharpens Iron radio advertising family. At Lynbrook Baptist Church, we believe the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments to be the inspired word of God, inerrant in the original writings, complete as the revelation of God's will for salvation, and the supreme and final authority in all matters to which they speak. We believe in salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. This salvation is based upon the sovereign grace of God, was purchased by Christ on the cross, and is received through faith alone, apart from any human merit, works, or ritual. Salvation in Christ also results in righteous living, good works, and appropriate respect and concern for all who bear God's image. If you live near Lynbrook, Long Island, or if you're just passing through on the Lord's Day, we'd love to have you come and join us in worship. For details, visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org. This is Pastor Keith Allen of Lynbrook Baptist Church reminding you that by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast. May the Lord bless you in the knowledge of himself.
And don't forget, folks, that this program is also paid for in part by the law firm of Buttafuoco & Associates. If you're ever the victim of a very serious personal injury or medical malpractice anywhere in the United States, please call my longtime, very dear friend, going back to the 1990s, 1991, actually, Daniel P. Buttafuoco, and brother in Christ, at 1-800-NOW-HURT, 1-800-NOW-HURT, or visit Dan's website, 1-800-NOW-HURT.com. Make sure you tell Dan that you heard about his law firm, Buttafuoco & Associates, from Chris Arnzen of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Also, want to remind all men in ministry leadership, you are invited to the next free biannual Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastors Luncheon on Thursday, October 1st, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Church of the Living Christ in Loysville, Pennsylvania, featuring for the very first time ever as our keynote speaker, Dr. David A. Harrell, pastor of Calvary Bible Church in Jolton, Tennessee, and author of a number of books, including the book from which he is giving his keynote address Why America Hates Biblical Christianity. Everything is free, and also every man that attends will receive two heavy sacks of free brand-new books personally selected by me and donated by Christian publishers all over the United States and the United Kingdom. If you'd like to register, send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com and put Pastor's Luncheon in the subject line. Make sure you give me your full name, the full name of your church or parachurch ministry, its location, and the number of men who will be joining you. That's chrisarnson@gmail.com. Put Pastor's Luncheon in the subject line. And last but not least, don't forget that this program is also paid for in part by our very dear friends for many years, the publishers of the New American Standard Bible, who have just renewed their advertising contract. If you are interested in purchasing a New American Standard Bible, or perhaps replace the Bibles in your pews at the church in which you serve with a brand new American Standard Bibles, go to nasbible.com, nasbible.com, and make sure you mention Iron Trip and Zion Radio. We are now back with Cat Owens, and I had to ask you, as I said before the break, please explain your chapter, Sugar, the Strongest God-Given Appetite.
Yeah, so we already talked a little bit about carbohydrates and that your body needs carbohydrates. There's a reason we have a craving for these. So carbohydrates, whether they're coming from starches like grains or sugars like the sugar in fruit or even just cane sugar, those are all getting broken down into your body into glucose, which is the energy source for that almost every cell in your body prefers. It's our main energy source. It's essential for tons of different functions in your body. And so there's a reason that we crave carbohydrates and sugars, is that we need that energy. And the human body is actually designed for quick digesting, energy-rich foods. We aren't cows that have four stomachs and are meant to be eating grass. That's an animal created by God to take in a lot of roughage and fiber and ferment it inside their body into energy. That's not how the human body was designed. We have one stomach. We have a digestive system and intestines that are meant to be absorbing energy. Even easily digested, energy-rich sources of food like grains and sugars. And so the point I'm trying to make with that chapter is that, first of all, we shouldn't be concerned at all about carbohydrates, because we know there's a lot of talk about that now. But also, we don't even need to be concerned about some of these so-called refined carbohydrates if we're eating them in the right context. So something like fruit juice or even cane sugar, that's getting digested in your body and turned into energy. And people talk about it as if that's a bad thing. But energy is a good thing. Energy is what we use to perform all our body functions. And now, are there certain situations where if someone has a metabolic problem and they can't use that energy well, is that going to create, could that create short-term problems? Absolutely. There's some nuance there. But for the most part, we're meant to be eating energy. And if we have a healthy metabolism that's using energy for the right things, you know, the way I think of it is kind of like energy in your body can go one of two directions. If you have problems with your metabolism is not healthy, extra energy coming in, that can be going to things like fat storage. If you have a healthy metabolism, that energy is going to be supporting things like hormone function, your brain function, all kinds of good things. So we shouldn't necessarily think that sugar or energy or calories in general are a problem and that we need to be restricting those or limiting those. So there's a lot of things we hear about sugar specifically, and I'm talking now about like cane sugar, that actually just aren't true. We hear a lot of things about, you know, sugar causes diabetes. And that's actually based on a misunderstanding of metabolism that is actually based on this idea that your body's kind of malfunctioning. And I think it's a more glorious perspective of God's creation to understand that what's going on is actually not that your body is just mistaken or malfunctioning. What's happening how most people develop metabolic conditions, like something like diabetes, for example, is that it's not that you're just eating too much sugar or you have too much sugar in your body for some reason. What's happened is that because of stress, oxidative stress, which can come from a lot of different sources, but those seed oils that we talked about are a prime culprit. Over time, those are damaging your mitochondria, where they can't take in energy and use it effectively. But your body knows that your cells need that energy, that glucose, that sugar even. Your body knows that your cells need that. And so your body starts creating more of it to desperately try to get enough into your cells for your cells to be able to perform their functions. So when someone has prediabetes or type 2 diabetes and their blood sugar is elevated, that's not because of sugar you ate. That's because of sugar that actually your liver is creating to desperately try to get enough sugar into your cells for the cells to perform that function. It's not a mistake. It's your body's intelligent response to a situation where there's been damage inside the body. And so what happens is a lot of people say, well, this high blood sugar in cases like type 2 diabetes is harmful, so therefore sugar in food is harmful. And that's a big leap, and that's just not what's happening. So if you're eating cane sugar and you're not overeating it, you're not eating it at the exclusion of more nutrient-dense foods in your diet, I don't see a problem with that. There's nothing about that that is actually, if you just really look at the science and a really true, honest interpretation of the science, there's nothing about that that is actually inherently harmful. That's not the same thing as the chronically elevated blood sugar that we see in metabolic conditions. And there's nothing inherently harmful about a food that is not packed with micronutrients. Sugar, even cane sugar, provides macronutrients. It provides carbohydrates, right? I like to remind people, macronutrients are nutrients too. There's nothing inherently harmful about macronutrients. And we hear things about sugar turns off your immune system. It's just not true. If you just look at the science, these things just aren't true. So when I tell people you can cook your own foods at home and they're going to be way better than what you would get pre-made from a grocery store or from a restaurant, I am not talking about replace the cupcakes at your kid's birthday party with muffins made of nothing but applesauce and almond flour and flax seeds. And you can't tell the difference, I promise. Yeah, right. I'm talking about you can actually make your own cupcakes, your own cake at home. And you can do this with good ingredients, like use butter, not a seed oil. Like most cakes at a grocery store would be packed with seed oils. You can do this at home, and that can still be a perfectly enjoyable food that's not going to be harming your health. Don't make it the only thing you eat, of course, but you can enjoy that without thinking that it's going to be harming your health.
Now, how does somebody counteract the fact that they have diabetes or high blood sugar and they don't want to be on insulin and they don't want metformin? What are they supposed to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you take someone who has a metabolic condition like that, cutting out the carbohydrates can certainly get a lot of those problems under control really fast. And that's one of the benefits that people see with a low carbohydrate diet is they cut that sugar out of the diet and it's going to get that blood sugar stable. And that's going to cut out a lot of the symptoms, a lot of the blood values that they're seeing on their tests that are problematic. But like I mentioned earlier, long-term, the problem with that is that your body's actually then going to create this physiologic insulin resistance where your fasting blood sugar then starts going up. So that's not the solution. What I would say, what I've seen be, I think, the most effective, best long-term strategy for someone with a metabolic condition is, first of all, work on those root causes. You've got to get the seed oils out of your diet. There's other things that can contribute to oxidative stress, like even just stress in your environment. And there's a lot of things that can be involved with sunlight and your circadian rhythms and everything, but seed oils are probably one of the big ones. So address those root causes. And then people with metabolic conditions seem to do really well with actually high carb but low fat diets. This doesn't mean that there's anything inherently wrong with fat, that everyone should be eating a low fat diet, but for someone trying to address a metabolic condition, that seems to be a really good way to address the metabolism in a way that is going to help those mitochondria start getting healthy again to where they can start using glucose effectively again. Because remember, that's the root cause problem, is that the mitochondria are not using glucose effectively.
Well, to order the book, you can go right to the website of Cat Owens, which is eatbyfaith.online, eatbyfaith.online. And you can also check out founderspress.org, founderspress.org. I want to thank you, Cat, for being such an utterly fascinating guest. I look forward to your return to the show. I want everybody listening to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner.